In general, unrelated question.
I'm recording. Can still ask the question, but
totally unrelated. I don't want to.
We're recording, so maybe we'll do that at the end. Okay. Good evening. We're beginning, or rather, we're ending a whole parsha here. Last week we did four parakim. We did four chapters in one lesson, chapter 4 through 7. And this, we saw the travels of the Lost Ark, and basically there are a number of issues that I wanted to deal with this week, so I have two pages to give you. One which some of you may have from last week, which I hope some of you kept from last week, because I don't have many to give out, so I'm assuming that it was held on to. I've got a few. If you haven't got the page from last week, there's a few here. There's three pages that I have. You just want to give those out. The first issue we dealt with, which we spoke about last week, was the question of whether there was one Oren or two. Okay, the famous story of the Oren being captured, and the question was, which Oren was it? Was it the original glorious Oren that we read about in the Torah, or was there a second Oren? Okay, and the second Oren could have had the broken tablets in it, and was more suitable to take to a war, to a battlefield, than the original ark, which clearly was something that you don't take out of the Beit HaMikdash very easily, very lightly. So we saw last week there were two opinions. As always, there's going to be two opinions, and whichever opinion you follow, whether it's Rabbi Yehuda ben Lakish or the Rabbanan, whatever happened, either they took the original Oren, and of course that in itself was something that was clearly unacceptable, or they took the second Oren as opposed to the first Oren, and the avail was they were relying on the Oren and not on their ability to do teshuva. Basically, they should have been much more circumspect in their behavior and what they were hoping to achieve, and what they did, you know, bring the magic Oren and everything will be fine. And of course it wasn't fine. On the contrary, they profaned it, and as a consequence the Oren was captured. And remember, it was taken to the Plishtim, and they put it into their Avodah Zarah, next to their Avodah Zarah, and their Avodah Zarah was collapsing every time that they left it. So they decided that they were going to move it around, and then they started getting plagues and terrible diseases, and it was a pretty bad situation. So eventually they sent it back. And this is the issue I want to deal with today, number two on the sheet, which is the question of what happened when it came back. It came back via Beit Shemesh. And in Beit Shemesh, the men of Beit Shemesh, who seemingly were very honorable, noble people, okay, they were afflicted. It says 50,070 men. Strange number. And Rashi said two possibilities. Either it was 50,000. Each one of them was like the 70 men of the Sanhedrin. So they were pretty holy guys. Or it was the other way around. 70 men were killed. They were each the equivalent of 50,000 men. Whichever way you look at it, you're talking about some very choshev yidden. You're talking about some very important people. So why were they punished? Why? It says they're working in the field, and the Oren came by, and instead of, essentially, what happened next is that they seem to have looked towards the Oren, and there was this terrible plague. So the question is, what's going on here? And I preface the remarks I'm going to make with a couple of comments from what's happened in the last couple of weeks. There's been unbelievable spate of patirot, of people who have passed away in various countries and of the religious community with a very frightening common denominator between them. Yesterday, the Mir Rosh Yeshiva passed away, Reb Finkel, not from Nosson Finkel, the one that I think many of you have been to see, but his, I think it's his second cousin, Reb Beinish, who was the original Rosh Yeshiva, the one that actually knew Reb Beinish in Israel. His nephew was this Reb Elia Finkel. And at 60 years old, he had a heart attack yesterday or 2 days ago, and he passed away. Just literally ala makom. And the Mir Yeshiva was in a terrible shock about this, and he had a tremendous kesher apparently with the American boys. I guess he spoke English, that's part of the deal. And it was a big shock. And last week or 2 weeks ago in London, there was a tremendous philanthropist, Ben Sion Dunner, whose family was kind of related to by marriage. His grandfather was the Av Beis Din in London, and Nebuch, the guy, was driving from London to Bournemouth, which is like sort of a coastal town, and he also had a heart attack, 45 years old. And this is a man that sat on Purim night, that Thursday night, before he was driving to the coast on the Sunday or Monday, whenever it was, and he was writing checks, over $1 million in checks, of Stocker, giving away to Stocker. And when he was asked about this, and they asked him over the years, he made a lot of money in property. And they asked him, you know, why do you give away so much money? So he said to him, I'm God's postman. That's all he said, right? That's the way he put it. He's the shaliach. And he literally would give away thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds, dollars or whatever you want to call them. Unreal. And also Beli Teitelbaum passed away also at a very young age. Beli Teitelbaum, who some of you may know from Camp Steichener and Brooklyn, very, very amazing man. I have a wonderful memory of him because one of the first Camp Steichener came back via London. And I just got engaged. And what happened was that my brother-in-law was involved with Camp Steichener, and they came and they did a Mlava Malkin in my parents-in-law's house in London. So we walked in, and there's this whole bunch of American guys, Mr. Ding, if you know Suki or Ding or what, one of them, whichever one it is. He was on the piano. Ellie was, this Rebelli was sort of doing a share. We walked in, and the place erupted because they just had the Chosin Kala walked into the room. Next thing I know, I'm in the middle of a wedding, except it was in my mother-in-law's front room, and it was very un-English, but what was going on was like pandemonium. It was unbelievable. And for about 20 minutes, they had this tremendous celebration of our engagement, you know, much to the sort of, not the chagrin, I would say that word, but it was kind of a bit of a shock to the system. You know, I wasn't quite used to American guys at all doing what they did, and this was a very lively bunch of guys, I have to say. Rabbi Teitelbaum was sort of certainly egging them on as much as he could, and got to speak to him a bit. A very chashuv man, very, very wonderful person, and again, the world has lost the somebody who really just spoke about things, but did things. He really was a doer. And again, you know, there's like a scary kind of theme running through all of these Ptirot in the last couple of weeks. And these are young men who really, certainly in today's world, you know, 45, 60, whatever they are in their 60s, is not an age. And yet they are, as it were, taken away from us. And, you know, maybe we can put some sort of perspective on it by looking at this particular piece in front of us. We're asking about the Medrash Shemesh, sorry?
No, about Roland, no, too, right?
And I don't know, there's maybe more. I don't know. No, I didn't hear about it.
Lalanik's Bafut.
Oh, right.
And his son comes here. He married, obviously, Judith.
Oh, yes, yeah, I know that. He sits at the front, yes.
But his father was the ambassador to the Netherlands, yeah. American ambassador to the Netherlands.
Yeah, yeah.
And Besezer, perhaps the biggest benefactor in the Jewish community today.
Really?
Yeah.
63 years old. 63 is unbelievable. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I just, you know, and we hope that this is like the end of that particular, and obviously we think back to the boys that were killed in Merkaz. This is all, you know, it's all sort of coming in the same, literally in the same kind of flow. And that in itself is something which, you know, something to think about, certainly something for our generation to think about. But listen to this. There is a suggestion here. We're going back to the men of Beit Shemesh, who clearly were very, very important, very, you know, sort of holy men. This is what we're told about them. And yet they were punished so severely. The Aron makes its way through Beit Shemesh, and they did what they did. And as a result, 50,000 and 70 of them were killed. So this is number two on the sheet. I just want to go through this a bit. This is taken again from the Sefer of Levi, Yitzhak Levi, whose writings we've been using since we started learning. Essentially, we started already with him in Sefer Shoftim. But we're using a bit of what he wrote in Sefer Shmuel as well. And he writes in section number two, Ashelezu Ramez Rabbi Yudah Levi, B'tshuva Sachove L'Kuzari. Right, those of you who never read the Kuzari, it's kind of absolutely a must. I mean, it's one of those books that if you just cannot sort of be Jewish, I think, without actually reading the Kuzari. Particularly what he says about Eretz Yisrael and Libi B'Mizrach and these famous things that he writes there, you know, Rabbi Yudah Levi, and it's a fabulous book, and you know, one has to really, it's not a book you read, it's a book you study, you have to really learn. There needs to be a Kuzari share. I'm not volunteering to do that. I did a Kuzari share once in London, and it's hard work, but it's worthwhile. But anyway, so he says the following. He says that there is a discussion. The Kuzari, for those of you who do not know, is based on a discussion between the king of the Khuzars, whether he was for real, whether he was not for real. There's a whole debate about that. And was there a country like that? And some say there was, some say there wasn't. And he's having a discussion with the Chaver. And the Chaver essentially is the rabbi who's teaching him about Judaism. Because he's looking for a religion for his country. The country is without religion, right? The country of Khuzar. And the king is looking for a religion, and the Chaver is explaining to him about Judaism. And why the book is so interesting is because he goes through Christianity and Islam before he gets to Judaism. Okay, there was a shocking statistic yesterday. There are more Muslims in the world than Catholics. Isn't that a scary thought? Just something to sort of give you a bit of a sleepless night. Sorry about that. But anyway, that came out yesterday from the Vatican of all places. They're obviously quite worried. I think we should all be worried, but anyway. It says the following. Second line. So there was a question here. So the question is, how is it possible? There's such a great congregation, like the Jewish people. Right, I hope you have, do you have the, hang on, let me give you this one. And then, it's like a two sheets, and I'll use the original. So he says there's such a great congregation as the Jewish people, right? So the question was, how can he keep so many mitzvot? How is it possible for such a large number of people to keep so many commandments? Okay, that was the question. It was like a simple question, not an easy question to answer. What was the response? So the Chaver says, "Chuvato aita." So the answer was, underline third line, "Shehumitok malatam sheYisrael kedushatam." The Am Yisrael has a tremendous potential. Okay, this is the real meaning of the chosen people. Chosen people, not in the, I think actually, somebody once put it, really should be called the choosing people, right? Not chosen by God, we chose God. According to the Midrash, you know, God offered the Torah, we chose it, we sort of agree. You can argue it was by force with the mountain over our heads or whatever, but the reality is that there's more to say about that. Am Segula means that we have a tremendous potential, a tremendous depth, a tremendous ma'ala, as he calls it, a tremendous high point that we can achieve. And he says in the fourth line in the inverted commas, "Ha'idash et sofer shon shava gomla li'ita betocha ratzolamar hashechina." In other words, Tahayda, what does he mean? "Ha'idah ro'et hashkachat Hashem tamid alev." That this is a congregation. The Jewish people understand that God is constantly with them. "Asher mikocha ba'al gemul," which brings you to reward. "Al maser tekel miyad," an immediate reward potentially for what you do. In the same place. And this is proof from Yoshua. Basically, there's a story there which I don't want to go into with Yoshua. And essentially, the idea is that if the Jewish people merit it, they will get rewarded by God in a very wonderful way. Because we are, as it were, the Shekhinah dwells amongst us. But the problem is, there's a price to pay. And the price to pay is that God is very particular, very pedantic with us. And if we are not living up to that standard, every generation, according to what is expected of the generation, I will add, right? We're not expected to be Moshe Rabbeinu's generation, but we're expected to be as good as we can possibly be in our generation, which is a problem. The punishment comes upon us also at that time. And the Kuzari talks about the whole story that we learned last week about Beit Shemesh. Ki ro baron Hashem. They looked at the Oren. Now what happened? Second paragraph, and this is where it gets very interesting. Havi Omer, Shemalatam Shel Yisrael Kivatam Hashchina. The fact that we are so close to the divine presence brings upon us immediate and severe punishment. Wow, that's a very strong statement, a very, very dramatic statement. We always wonder, why us? Why do we get this? You know, why does it happen to us? Why do we lose these good people? Why do these terrible things that happen? And I don't want to go to the big picture of the Holocaust and everything else. And the answer he's giving here, the Kuzari is saying, is because we're so close to God that God is very, very strict with us. And the punishment comes for not living up to the standard that we're expected to live up to. Now again, this is, I don't want to go into the whole Holocaust theology thing because it's much more complicated in a way, but it's interesting what he's saying here if we're looking at the men of Beit Shemesh. And the second line of that paragraph, even if the sins don't seem to be so severe, ad kedei mitat alfayish, it can cause the death of thousands of men. And of course, what's happening with Beit Shemesh is that they are talking about the Mikdash. They are looking at the Ark, and they are, as it were, being mezalzel. They're not treating the Ark in the absolute sense of holiness in the way that they should. The next column, as with the sin that we read last Shabbos with Nadav and Aviv, the same thing. There's a story that in Sefer Shemot, where these great men who were feasting of the divine presence, whatever that means, they weren't treating it with the right respect, and as a result, they were punished. The Chol Kitvei HaKodesh melamdim al yichuzeh shel Beit Yisrael. And therefore, this is a principle, certainly in Tanakh, is that the high standard that we can achieve demands a higher standard of behavior. And of course, if we don't live up to that high standard of behavior, then we are, as it were, in a position to bring upon ourselves more severe onesh and more severe punishment than it would seem looking at the situation, sort of trying to look at it objectively. So again, we've got the men of Beit Shemesh, and they seem just to give a glance at the urn, and they don't seem to behave the way they should, and as a result, 50,000 are killed. It blows the mind. And he goes to the Pasuk, and he shows you what's going on here. Hu adavar, just to continue. Shalmir Manshei Beit Shemesh, this is what the men of Beit Shemesh said. Vayom Manshei Beit Shemesh, the men of Beit Shemesh said, Mi yuchal amod b'fnei Hashem Elokim HaKadosh Hazeh, who can stand before the Holy God? Mi yaleh, who will go up? Aron Hashem Elokim, who will take up the oil from us? In other words, if we're going to be punished, who's going to be able to take it over? Halo HaGadolim Shebanu Metu, the great ones amongst us die. So who's going to take it over? Who's going to check their life insurance to make sure that they're not going to have a problem here? You know, it's one of those things that if we can't stand the pressure and we can't live up to the expectation because we didn't give the Oren the absolute respect that it deserved, then who's going to be able to take over? Remember what happened was, he went off to Kiryat Yarim to the house of a guy called Avinadav, I think his name was, and seemingly he was a guy he was able to give the required respect to the Aaron in a way that the men of Beit Shemesh did not. Okay, and that's really the bottom line. But look what he says in this final paragraph. This gives me the chills. He says, "Amakah kasha sheba aleinu, al shelo nahagnu b'kavod rosh ha'ori." We get this affliction because we don't treat the item with the respect that it requires. A teacher of mine put a shir on the web. Somebody called Rav Ben Yaakov, who's a wonderful teacher, teaches in Mavaseret, he was teaching me 25 years ago, and he's still giving shiur in Mavaseret, really from France. Ben Yaakov, I used to call him Rabbi Jacobson, because I used to pull his leg, because his name was Jacobson, it became Ben Yaakov. So, you know, I used to sort of go back to his roots, I tried to, he never accepted that. But he spoke about the events in Melkas, and it was a 20-minute shiur, but it just blew me away. He said, any time that we've started to talk about compromise of Yerushalayim, he said, it's only brought disaster upon us. He says, think back to the year 2000 and what happened there. Compromise, Barak was talking about it, and the next thing we know, we've got an intifada on our hands. And Nebuchadnezzar, how many hundreds and if not thousands have been killed. And you know, we were talking again recently about Yerushalayim. And Nebuchadnezzar, out of that, look what happened. The guys were sitting, they were doing a Chagigah for Purim, or Rosh Chodesh Adar, whatever it was, and Nebuchadnezzar, this terrible, terrible tragedy occurred. And he says there cannot be, as far as we are concerned, I'm not talking politics, he's talking religiously, spiritually, compromise on Jerusalem is out of the question. Yerushalayim is one of those things that we just are not allowed to talk about in terms of anything else but the fact that it remains in Shechub Belayachdam. Right, it's part of our heritage, Yerushalayim. I always argue, Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim. It's an inheritance for the people. Right, it's something that we need to hold on to. And we're discussing, and the politicians are talking about this bit going and that bit. And then Nebuchadnezzar, we get a reminder, a terrible reminder. And that was his shiur for 20 minutes, but it really shook me up a bit because, you know, to him it's kind of sort of obvious as why these events took place. And to tell you the truth, You feel that, but you ask yourself, you know, why these innocent boys, these 14, 15-year-olds, they're the korban for the nation. That's something that we really don't have an answer. But the message of it, the response of it, was very powerful. And this is what we're saying here. We're saying that sometimes things happen because we don't give the COVID rush. We don't deal with things in the respect and the gravitas that it deserves. And we need to learn from that. And he just says in the last paragraph, the second line, Himchishalana Shain Anu Gdolim Vidayenu Lamo Bitaviota Mahmirot Me'eta Krovim Nashratashkina. We're very close to God, but that demands a lot of respect and behavior which we have to live up to. And in essence, he says, this is what happened after Karach was swallowed up, and the whole group with it, and people died the next day. What did Am Yisrael say? They said that we're all dying. Anyone who's near the Mishkan will die. We saw it, you know, that this is the point, that we weren't, that the whole community took it upon themselves that Korach is being punished. They felt that it was something that was, they didn't live up to, the whole nation, and they were suffering for it. As Rashi points out, they felt we could not be careful enough to avoid this. How are we going to keep going? And also there was a group, the sons of Kahat, one of the Levite groups, Shenosu called Kleakot, they carried the Kleakotish, they used to carry all the vessels of the temple, Ha'aron Hayam Mechala b'bnei Kahat, and unfortunately they didn't live very long, they had very short lifespan, because they carried the Aron, and presumably every so often they would see it, even if they didn't want to, and he says it used to create a lot of problems, it shortened their lives, they died very young. Vayam Matan Shayim Akatsay Yameim. It shortened their days. And this is the pasuk we read last week, Bikrovai Akadesh. And that's a very difficult concept. And as I said, you know, the thought of the last couple of weeks of the Krovai, the people who are close to Hashem, it doesn't necessarily mean people who are sort of even involved so much in learning, but people involved in philanthropy, whatever it is, you know, in particular in the religious community, and Ekadesh, you become holy by this, but of course it's very scary. You know, when the community loses one of these guys, it's enough. When the community loses a whole spate within a very short period of time, Chodesh Adar, Mishnich Zah Mar V'Simcha, you know, it's one of those things that we really are being given, we understand there is a reminder, there's something happening here. And again, as I said, we'll never really understand the whys, but we certainly have to understand the responses. What do we do about it? Okay, and I just want to say that I don't usually go into Musa here. I'm not a Baal Musa. I really refuse to do it. But on this occasion, I think, particularly as what happened yesterday, Le'ilu Nishmat, certainly this Rosh Yeshiva, who seems to have been a very, very wonderful individual, and certainly the gentleman in London, Mr. Dunner, who also, you know, sort of I knew of. I never knew him personally, but I knew of him. These are very special people, along with the other people I mentioned. And let's just hope that their neshamas have aliyah. All right, that's the point that I wanted to make about the Anshei Beit Shemesh, and something certainly to take away and think about. On the back of the page, I just want to leave you on this particular point with one or two extra thoughts. We said that the ark, remember, was left in Kiryat Yarim, and it wasn't kept in Beit Shemesh. And of course, this is the continuation of what we're just saying. This is question number 3 on the other side of the page that you have. Kimirah, are you Yoshua Kiryat Yarim? You do in Bechasidutam, Betzidkutam. Okay, the people living in Kiryat Yarim were seemingly more righteous than the ones living in Beit Shemesh. Kimikola Re Yisrael Nivchara Irzu Lashkim Bat Aron. That's where the Aron went. So one has to assume that that was a holier place. Kiryat Yarim today, as I said, is Telstone, right? So it's a very, very chashuv yeshuv there. There's Srim Shanan. He was there for 20 years. And then David took the Oren up to Jerusalem. It never, ever came back to the Mishkan after that. It stayed in Kiryat Yarim. And from there, it went up to Yerushalayim, and there's that wonderful story when David was dancing in front of the Aron, and Michal got very upset because she thought he was belittling himself. You know, she didn't understand what David was about. She really didn't get David at all, which is sad. And there's a lot to say about that when we get to Shmuel Ben. And Husha Hashem ve'ein peretz ve'ein tzvachah b'chovotah. Once it came to Kiryat Yarim, there was no problem, there was no plague or anything else. It stayed there, and that's where it was for 20 years. And basically, that's really this section over here of section number 3. And then in section number 4, we are asking why did it not go back to Nob? In the end of the day, all right, Kiryat Yarim was a good place, but put the Aron back to where it should have gone, which is the Mishkan. The Mishkan was in a place called Nob. Why didn't the Aron go back? So the section A over here is the Meiri in question number 4, who says, Av shechazar lehem ha'aron. Even though the Aron came back from the Plishtim, lo kavur me Mishkan, didn't go back to the Mishkan. Why? Lo benov velo begivon, either to Nov or to Givon, wherever the Mishkan was. Midneshim mityarim hayu alav shelo yishmu panasah. That it was a practicality. They didn't want it to be captured the second time, just in case it might get captured again. Keep it separate. So the best thing to do is to put it into a place which was protected, and presumably Kiryat Yarim had some sort of wall around it, so the oil would never ever be captured again by outside forces. We could never ever bring ourselves to go through that ever again. And that's the Meiri's suggestion, and the Radak over here in section B basically points out that David had eventually a reason, already was done, it was kept separate from the Mishkan, because really the Oron was now, as it were, leading the way to Yerushalayim, right? This was now going to be the way that they were going to start dedicating Yerushalayim. Remember, David wanted to build the Beit HaMikdash, and he was refused for doing so for lots of reasons. Again, we'll read about in Shmuel Ben. And you'll see, just the Radak points out, Lama Lohevi David et Aron leGivon. In the end of the day, why did David, later on, not bring the Aron to Givon if the Mishkan was still in Givon, and Jerusalem was not yet established as the place to house the Aron? Why didn't David take it to Givon? Shahaya Sham Aron Moed, which is where the Mishkan was. Lefi Sheyodah, so Radak points out, Ki Aron Moed Hayatid Lavo Yerushalayim. David knew all of this was going to go to Jerusalem. The Chashaki Biyamavi is there. So David thought it was going to happen in his day. Who you've now? Mikdash. He was going to build the Mikdash. So for him to schlep the Aron back to Givon and then take it from there to Yerushalayim, he felt better to do, rather, as they say, than going around the houses, he was going to go directly to Yerushalayim with the Aron, which is exactly what he did. Right? You look, I think, in Shmuel Bet, it's like Perek Vav, Perek Zayin, I don't remember now, and you'll read there this wonderful description of how David takes the Aron up to Yerushalayim, and it really is quite unbelievable. As I said over here in the conclusion, there is a problem of central leadership. All of this chapters we learned, chapter 4, 5, 6, and 7, are all based on this real problem of the leadership, the central leadership. And of course, by the time we get to the end of chapter 7, there is a repair. The repair is Shmuel. Shmuel is now doing something, as we read. And again, just to point out to you, look at the end of Perek Zion, chapter 7, the last two Pesukim. What did Shmuel do? So last three Pesukim, just to bring that to your attention again, because we're going to have one more item just to talk about. Vayishbot, Pasuk Tedva, verse 15. Vayishbot Shmuel Yisrael, he judged Israel, Kol Yimei Chayav, all the days of his life. There was a standard that Shmuel established, which lasted essentially right throughout his life. Vayalach Midei Shana B'Shana, and he used to take it to the people. Okay, this is great. Vasavav Beit El, Vagilgal V'Mitzpeh. And he went to Beit El, Gilgal, Mitzpah. You know, he was out there. He was bringing the religion. He was like Chabad. I mean, you know, he was doing the stuff. V'shafat et Yisrael et kol ha'makomot ha'ela. And he judged Israel in all these places. And here comes the crunch. And this is such an interesting process. We didn't talk about this last week. U'tshuvatar amatar kisham beito. I did mention that this is one of the few places you find the word teshuva. Okay, the Reb Soloveitchik talks about this in his lectures. I mentioned that already. But what does it say at the end here? V'sham shafatet Yisrael, v'yivin sham mizbeach l'Hashem. This is where he judged Israel, and he built a mizbeach l'Hashem. Again, tshuvatah ramatah ki sham beito. It says that his house was there. The rabbis say, wait a second, Shmuel, if we go back to the story we learned right at the beginning of the Sefer, his mother promised that he would be where for the rest of his life? In the Mishkan. So what does it mean his house was in Ramah? Okay, if he's in the Mishkan, then he's in the Mishkan. He's not in Ramah. Okay, so what's he saying over here? Tshuvata Ramataki Sham Beito. Right? What is he doing that his house is there? Where? Is it in Ramah? Ramah is a different place to the Mishkan. Okay, we understood that he was going to be always living, being part of the Mishkan. So what's Sham Beito? Here comes an unbelievable statement. Unbelievable. Look at the Radak, if you have the Radak in front of you. And the Radak says something fabulous, right? You know, we Lahavda, everything we spoke about just before, in the world of leadership, political leadership, we've gone through scandals at the moment which are blowing the mind. Okay, you know, it's either idiotic behavior of leaders or irresponsible, whichever word you want to use, it's just breathtaking. Okay, how people in positions of leadership, secular position of leadership, can literally throw their lives away for things which really don't make sense. Look at what a leader Shmuel was. Says the Radak, Tshuvata Ramata Kisham Beita. I hope you have his Pasuk Yud Zayin. Very small print, right? I have to take off my glasses, right? That's the only way to do it. Kisham Beita. And look at this. In Sham Komot Rechokim. זולתי אותם שזכה שהיה סבב היו בהם שם ברמה לפניו למשפט. The first thing he says was that Shmuel went around, but if they couldn't, he couldn't get to the people, they would come to him in Ramah. It was known that he would be there, I suppose, certain months in the year, and they would come to Ramah, and that's where they would do their Din Torah, whatever they had to do. Now, Rabbeinu Doshu, the rabbis say, wait a second, Sham Beit Torah has got a lot more to say than that. Doshu, the rabbis explain, B'chol makom she'alech beito imo. Wherever he went, he took his household with him. Traveling, he basically went in a trailer. Okay, you know, now they're what in English we call a caravan. Klomar shelo yaneh me'adam ela mishelo. You know, no expense account. As far as Shmuel was concerned, to take one penny from the public was absolutely unacceptable. This is a person that wherever he went, he paid for his own expenses, he took his house with him, right? You know, he set up shop. If he was in Eilat, then Eilat was his buying. And if he was in the north, in Nahariya, Nahariya was his house. And if he was in Tel Aviv, Tel Aviv was his house. You know, wherever he went in Eretz Yisrael, that was his house, meaning that he expected no benefit from anybody, to remain absolutely impartial. Unbelievable. Upeirosh Sham, it says Sham. Why does it say his house was there? Bechol amakom says the Radak. In all the places, Shayas Soved, wherever he went around, that's where his house became established. And this was the significance of his leadership was beyond belief, that he established a standard of justice and of judges, which was not in any way recognized till now. He brought the whole nation, he brought them up to a point which really, you know, we said on Friday night, Moshe v'Aaron b'karno, u'Shmuel b'kor Shemo. He's on a par with Moshe and Aaron. He took the nation back to the status that maybe they were in the days of Moshe and Aaron. And there've been tremendous lapses in the in between stage. Remember how they'd gone down in the period of Shoftim, and it was ups and downs. And you know, you had a Shimshon, everything was strong, and then he disappears, and then you get the Pelegesh b'Givah, and you get these awful stories at the end of Sefer Shoftim, and it was a problem. And here Shmuel is establishing standards of honesty for leadership which are just breathtaking. There is no concept of him in any way abusing the goodwill of the public. He doesn't want to know. He's going to pay his own way, and whatever he does on his own cheshbon, on his own account. And Sham Beito, wherever he goes, that's where his house is. And when he goes back to Ramah, so that will be the one place where people will come to him as opposed to where he goes to them. But essentially, wherever he found himself, Sham Beito. And that's a very, very amazing thing. You know, as I said, you're looking at the world around us. Wow, it's not quite the same. Let's be kind. I'm not going to say any more than that. I just want to show you, again, let me just give out these sheets very quickly. So, Lou, if you can just pass them around. And just to emphasize the point. Oh, is that the original? Okay. Just to emphasize the point of Sham Beito, if you can just maybe... Sorry, Boris, I want to just send those around as well. Just pass them back.
Same one?
Yeah, it's the same sheet, yeah. You'll see on the sheet in front of you, I just want to show you from the side here the various Gemaras that talk about this. Okay, because we saw the Radak, but the Radak was quoting the Gemara. So I just want to show you the Gemara here of Shmuel. And of course, the reason why we're emphasizing this is really the segue into chapter 8. Perechet will be the watershed, as it were, of the whole of the Sefer Shmuel. Because at that point, for some reason which is not clear to us, the Jewish people turn around and say, Shmuel, you're great, you're wonderful and everything else, but we need a king. Okay, and that's going to be something we're going to have to deal with. We'll start talking about it maybe even today, but certainly in the next couple of weeks. But look at this page in front of you on the left-hand side, the quotes at the bottom. Omar Abayim. V'itema Rabbi Yitzchak, right? Harod Tzalano, the Gemara makes a whole big deal out of this. If you want to have benefit from something, Yehenek Elisha, have benefit like Elisha, and that's a whole discussion by itself I'm not going to go into. Elisha the prophet. She'ein Harod Tzalano, if you don't want to have benefit, Al Yehenek, don't have benefit, K'shmol Anoti, set yourself up like Shmuel. What does that mean? Shenema, because we read, this pasuk we just read, U'teshuvata Ramata, he goes back to Ramah, Kisham Beito, Rabbi Yochanan, Shekol Makom Shalach Sham Beito Emo. Wherever he goes, that's where his house was. Pirush Rashi, and Rashi explains, Le'el B'nei Ketiv, it says, with Shmuel, V'halach Midei Shana B'Shana, used to go around year by year, V'Savav Beitel, V'Gilgal, V'Mitzpeh, V'Shavat Yisrael. Okay, went from one place to the other, all different places. For Samach Le'en, next to that it says, U'tshuvata Ramata Kisham Beito. Why does he have to say that's where his house is? I know that's where his house is. If he was on the road and that's where he comes home, that's where his home is. But he says no. What we're saying is that everywhere was his bind. Right? Wherever he went, he took his house with him. He took his home with him. Shekol makom shalech sham, wherever he went, says, this is a Gemara in Brochas, it says, Hayan oset klei tashmishei bayit imo, he took all of his pots and pans, literally everything. Unbelievable. Ve'ol chaniyato, and his tent, and, you know, even whatever he needed, all the home luxuries, which I'm sure he didn't have. Shelo lehanot min acherim, so as not to have any benefit from anybody else. Total independence. He's a leader and he knows that his position can be compromised and he was not going to allow any compromise whatsoever. It's a wow. And look what he goes on to say, Gemara Shabbos. V'chein omruzah, the rabbis say, Shaya Shmuel at tzaddik. Okay, not many people are called tzaddik. In the Torah, we know Yosef at tzaddik. And in the Gemara, Binyamin is called at tzaddik and Shmuel is called tzaddik. And I sort of question whether anybody else has got that title. Okay, when you call somebody tzaddik, it's a very special thing. I once read, and I was told this as, you know, when I was sort of studying for Smicha, is that the Mishnah Berurah is a fantastic halacha sefer, but a lot of poskim, you go by the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan was the Nevadaker of Rav Epstein. And the reason why they don't go by the Mishnah Berurah is an interesting answer. You know, you ask the question. Mishnah Berurah is a great halacha sefer. And the answer is Yechiel Mecher, right? Yechiel Mecher Epstein was a posek. He was a rov. And therefore, you know, he sort of kind of lived in the tzibur. Whereas the Chovitz Chaim, Rav Kagan, who wrote the Mishnah Berurah, he was a tzaddik. All right, so he was kind of out of the community. He wasn't really in touch with the day-to-day of life of the average commoner gardener Jew. And therefore, the reality is that sometimes it's better to paskin with the Rav who lived with the Tzibur rather than the Rav who lived above the Tzibur. So that's the word tzaddik that, you know, is used, I think, in that context. Very interesting. Again, sort of not many people left to remember the Chovitz Chaim. My teacher in London, Rabbi Fisher, Zichron Levrocha, one of the Dayanim in London, was a Talmud of the Chovitz Chaim. And he used to talk about his days in Radin. He was in Radin from Bar Mitzvah. He studied there for a year or two, from 13 to 15, his age. And he said the Chovitz Chaim, one of the things he told me, a story, which I thought was kind of a cool story. You'll read the stories about Chovitz Chaim, that he had issues with Lashon Hara, as we all know. Okay, didn't want to hear it. And the question was that they weren't sure whether he was deaf. Okay, was he really deaf or could he just switch it off? You know, when somebody was saying Lashon Hara, he kind of, I suppose nowadays you'd say switch off the hearing aid. But in those days he didn't have a hearing aid, he just became oblivious to it. So they weren't sure, the Bochim weren't sure. So Rabbi Fisher at that time was 13 years old and he was davening from the Omer in the yeshiva. He told this story. So he said what he did was he wanted to prove that Chovitz Chaim wasn't deaf. So how do you do that? So what he did was he got to the piece of davening just before Baruch Hu. All right, and he got to Baruch Hu, and he said Baruch Hu very quietly. Now, if the person was deaf and didn't hear it, they wouldn't respond straight away. If you were of hearing, you would respond because he said it quietly, but loud enough you could hear it. And of course, the Rabbi Chaim responded like everybody else. Okay, so Rabbi Fisher knew. He said at that point, I knew this man wasn't deaf. His hearing was absolutely 20/20 vision and everything else. This was a guy who was with it 100%, even though he was already in his 90s. He said the reality was that when he could switch off the hearing, he could switch it off. Unbelievable. I mean, you know, he trained himself to do that. It's something special, you know, that certainly to meet. I don't know how many people in America are alive who can say that they met the Chofetz Chaim, not that many anymore. He died in 1933. All right, that's about Tzaddik. I'm sorry, I just got sidetracked on Tzaddik, but it's kind of an interesting thing. So look at this. This is Gemara in Shabbos. Shahaya Shmuel HaTzaddik Mechazeh B'chol Mekol Yisrael. Shmuel the Tzaddik went to all the places in Israel. V'dana Tam Barim, he judged them at home. All right, he was the traveling judge. He came to you. Wonderful. You know, call 1-800... I don't know, what, judge? Shmuel, I don't know, whatever you want to call him. Shenema, because it says, V'alach midei shana b'shana, every year, v'savav beiteo v'gigo mitzvah v'shav Yisrael. That's the Gemara in Shabbos. And he goes, it just brings the third quote here, from the Midrash. U'bedome matzan of Midrash, lo natalti mishalahem. Shmuel, in the next chapter, says, I didn't take a penny from the Jews. What does that mean? K'shayiti chozeh, when I was going around, v'sed dineim v'tzachem, I was doing what they needed. V'olech v'savav b'chol erot Yisrael, I went to every city in Israel. Derech Olam, normally what happens, Balei Didim Olchim Eitzel Adayan, they come to the judge. V'ani Hayiti Olech V'Sovev Me'ir Lehim Mokom L'Mokom Chamur Olai. Right? And I went to them and it was very hard for me. But Shmuel said that that's the way he did it, because that was the way to establish absolute impartiality. There was no way that anyone could come to him and start compromising his situation. He established a standard of leadership, of integrity, which was really, I suppose you would say, par excellence. There was nothing like it. And again, why do I stress this? Because I want to look very briefly. We won't get very far today, but let's start looking at Perek Chet. And all of this is a segue into chapter 8, and really into, as I said, the parak, which really gives us a tremendous amount of heartache on behalf of Shmuel. And it starts like this, Vayihi, if you're with me, chapter 8, verse 1. Vayihi kasher zaken Shmuel. Shmuel was old. How old was he at this point? 50 years old. Zaken, right? He's an old man. 50 in those days, I don't know what to say. I don't know, because sometimes you say, you know, with Rivka, she was 3, and you say that 3 was like whatever. So, you know, sometimes being young is old, being old is young. I don't know, I'm very confused with the numbers. But whatever it is, Zaken Shmuel, he was getting on. But Yosem et Banav Shafti in Israel, so what did he do? Right? Like every father who's in that position, bit of nepotism, but he probably thought they were up to the job. He made his sons into the judges. And of course, we're told who they are. V'yishem b'no b'chor Yoel, v'shem mishnei aviyah, Yoel and aviyah. Shoftim b'Be'er, and this already gives us the clue there were judges in Be'er Sheva. So already Shmuel, remember, went from place to place. Be'er Sheva is a nice place, the climate is pleasant, Ben Gurion University is beautiful around there, you know, it's a lovely campus or whatever they had in those days, and it was a place, they set up shop down in Be'er Sheva. V'lo holchu banav bidrachav, and this is a very condemning verse. We saw it with Eli, the sons of Eli, and now with Shmuel, they did not go in his way. V'yitu achrei abotz, and they went after prophet. They took bribes and they perverted justice. And here, again, Chazal are trying to be apologetic, right? And you'll see again, the Radak brings this. The Radak on Pasuk Gimel. Rashi brings this already, but the Radak also talks about it. Says Rashi in Pasuk Gimel, Vayatu heim atzmat. They perverted justice themselves. They went after these bribes. Right, vayatu dovacher dahino mishpat. They perverted justice because they took bribes. They basically started the rot, the standard that Shmuel had established. As far as they were concerned, they probably thought the old man was a bit crazy, not taking money for what you're doing, and you're not. You know, this is a gold mine, and you're ignoring it. And they didn't see it the way he saw it. The rabbis come along and say, no, they weren't so bad. Rabbeinu amru lo chatu b'nei Shmuel. The rabbis explain, Shmuel, this is continuing Rashi, the b'nei Shmuel did not sin, and lo holchu b'dachei avim, they just did not go to the standard of their father. Shoyim mechazer b'chol mekumot Yisrael, he was going around all the places himself. V'shoftan b'areihem, and he was doing it in their place. He went to their cities. V'heim lo osu kein, they did not do so. K'dei l'harbot z'chal azanim, and they wanted to do people to come to them so that all of their workers would get the commissions, right? You know, if you've got a clerk and you've got a secretary, they would all take their commissions because you had to make an appointment. You know, we know the system, right? As it is today. And therefore the Sofrim and also the Sofrim. And basically what happened was that they changed the system. So according to the way the rabbis see it, there was not necessarily corruption going on here, but it was a change of the system. Rashi is prepared to say, the first explanation, that the reality was that they really became corrupt. And interestingly, the Radak, if you look at the Radak, where he brings exactly the same statements from Chazal, as well as the what we would call the Pshat, in the end of the day, what the Radak says, I think he points out more or less, without question over here, okay, yeah, on Pasuk Bet, the Radak at the end of verse 2, where he says, the last three lines of the Radak, like Rashi said, that they went to all the places, they didn't go to all the places like their father, they sat at home to increase the money for their clerks and people working for them. But of course that's considered as if they took a bribe. ומהם אמרו חלקם שאלו בפיהם, ומהם אמרו מתנות נתנו בזרוע. Right? לפי פשט הפוסק נראה שחטו. The Radak is prepared to say, Chazal want to play it down, but the reality is, if you learn this pasuk, it's pretty condemning. They really went after bribes. They did not, in any way, the rabbis try and push it, as it were, try to placate it a bit, right? Which is a derech of the Gemara, the famous Gemara in Gemara Shabbat, page 56, which does that for a number of cases. But in this case, says the Radak, the reality is that these were not such great guys. Okay, the father was who he was, and the sons came along, and he put the sons in a position of power, and one can only explain, as it does in all generations, power went to their heads. And instead of them behaving the way to the standard of Shmuel, wow, they really compromised the whole thing. And it says, you know, you can't get away from the words here. Vayiku shocha, vayatu mishpat. They took bribes and they perverted judgment. And I want to leave you just with these next few psukim, something to look ahead, something to think about. Vayitkapsu kol zignei Yisrael, vayavol shmuel amata. So all the elders of Israel came to Shmuel, and they were very unhappy, as you can well imagine. And here comes a pasuk which is going to give us a lot of analysis. They said to him, you are getting old, as I said, 50 years old. Not such an old man, but for them it was already getting beyond his sell-by. Your sons have not followed your derech. All right, they're not doing what you expect, not what we expect. Ata simulani melech l'shavtenu chol ha'goyim, comes out of left field. They say to him, we want a point for us, a king, l'shavtenu chol ha'goyim, to judge us like all the nations. We'll come back to that verse next week, we'll talk about it, because there's two ways of reading this pasuk. The Ram learns it one way, another version learns it another way. This is a key pasuk which we'll need to deal with. And of course, the question is, v'yira davar b'nei Shmuel kasher amru tanan melech l'shavtenu v'yitpaleh Shmuel Hashem. Shmuel saw it as a bad thing. And, you know, number one, question is, why ask for a king at this point in time? Number two, why did Shmuel take it so badly? If in the end of the day, it's a mitzvah to have a king, Sorem tosim alecha melech, then for goodness sake, why is it considered to be bad? All right? And, you know, the famous song is not what you do, right? It's the way that you do it. And of course, what we're going to see over here is not necessarily the what they did was wrong, but certainly the way, the timing, everything that this involves is, without doubt, very controversial indeed. And what happens, just one more passage, just for you to think about, Vayoma Hashem El Shmuel. Shmuel's, God responds straight away. God says, Shema b'kol ha'am l'chol ha'shem re'lecha, ki lo ata ma'asu ki oti ma'asim l'chol ha'am. They're not rejecting you, Shmuel, they're rejecting me. Wow, and this is even more difficult to understand. Hashem says they're rejecting me, and nevertheless, they want a king, they can have a king. So what's going on here? This seems to be a rejection of Shmuel, rejection of God, and everything we learn about Shmuel till now. And the people seem to respect Shmuel. They seem to, I suppose you would almost put it on the words of idolizing because of what he did, what he established, the standards of integrity, which his children did not live up to. So the people were obviously disappointed with him. And they come to Shmuel and they make such a request, and Shmuel sees it as a rejection of his position. Hashem says, it's not just a rejection of you, Shmuel, it's a rejection of me. And this, of course, requires tremendous analysis. What is really going on there? Especially if it's a mitzvah to have a king in the first place. So that's going to be the issue, Mitzvah Shem, that we'll deal with next week. please God, we'll try to do it next week if we can. And in the meantime, just something to think about, please read ahead, Perichet, because, I mean, the whole story really plays itself out over here in terms of appointing a king. And also think about this Pasuk, as I told you, the Pasuk here, Vayomer Elam, when they say to him, Melech l'shaft, Simalon and Melech shaftenu k'chol ha-goyim. I'm going to ask you just to think where you're going to put the comma, okay? Are you going to put the comma, Simalon and Melech l'shaftenu, comma, k'chol ha-goyim? Right, I'm not going to tell you what this means. I'll wait your appetite for next week. Or are you going to say, Simalon and Melech, comma, l'shaftenu k'chol ha-goyim? There's two ways of reading this pasuk, and we are going to come back to it, and we will sort of analyze this. You'll see that the Mefarshim, there's enormous perish on this. We'll look, Mitzvah Shem, also at the original mitzvah of appointing a king, because that obviously is very relevant to what's going on here. The concept of theocracy and democracy coming together. And that's an interesting concept in its own right. And in the end of the day, we'll try and come to some sort of explanation of what, in essence, is going on here. It's a very challenging topic. Mitzvah Shem to be continued next time. Shmuel HaNavi, wow. I mean, this man is a wow. We can only sort of, you know, sort of learn from his example. Have a good week, everyone. Thank you.